Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So hello, everybody. I'm very pleased to welcome my special guest, world-renowned academic, author and practitioner, Manfred Ketz de Vries. Manfred has huge achievements in his life. He's been the author and co-author editor of over 52 books, 400 academic papers. He's been featured in the New York Times, Financial Times, Harvard Business Review, The Economist. He's a distinguished clinical professor of learning and development and organizational change at INSEAD. He's been their program director of their lead top management program, and he was a founder of the Executive Masters in Change Management. Also, what interests me was he was a recipient of the Freud Memorial Award for his work bringing management and psychoanalysis together. So Manfred, a very warm welcome. How are you today?
Where I am, it's very hot, I can tell you that. I'm in the south of France, and it is quite warm. Beautiful weather. In the morning it's better. Now it's getting, as I said to you, the cucumber time. But I'm okay. I like it here because you don't see that, but I look over I'm on top of a mountain, which is kind of paradoxical, and it's a good place to write. And as I wrote in one of my last book, it sounds terrible, this pandemic, but it caused for me what is called by the Russians a Boldino Autumn moment, which was named after, the Russians know what it is, named after Pushkin, who was couldn't leave his estate because of a cholera epidemic, and it was his most productive period in his life. But maybe the other reason was that he had the Tsar always hanging over his neck because he was quite well known, and the Tsar personally censored him, so I don't have that here.
So you're hot and you're in south of France. I'm looking at your bookshelf. Behind you have a book called African Hunter. I know you're a great explorer. Are you still exploring?
Yes, I'm supposed to go salmon fishing at the moment. That's where I'm supposed to be in the Gaspésie. I used to live in Canada, so this is my time. I go salmon fishing, fly fishing. But yeah, Unfortunately, I get only reports from my friend who tells me all the salmon he's catching. Well, I'm quite frustrated, although it's a big garden where I am. So we have roebuck, wild boar, and foxes, and even badgers in the garden. But it's not the same as going salmon fishing in the Gaspésie. No.
Where I live in Galway, on the west of Ireland, and they salmon fish here as well. We see them fly fishing in the river. Beautiful sight.
Bad luck at the moment. I mean, I'm not going anywhere. The only thing I go to is to the marketing camp to go some shopping for vegetables. That's my highlight of the week or so. Anyhow, it's a pleasure to be. I listened to some of your podcasts, and they were quite interesting. But I don't know if I'm, at the moment I'm a member of the Explorers Club, the New York Explorers Club, which is a strange membership, but I'm at the moment exploring nothing. No. Maybe I'm still exploring some ways of dealing with virtuality and try to keep my classes alive. That's probably, which is not easy. It's probably much easier when you are at a business school in finance or artificial intelligence. But if you are in kind of soft skills, it's you can do something, and I'm doing something, but it's difficult.
It really is difficult. I'm launching my online coaching course tomorrow, actually. So we have 20 people from all over the world coming. So we're quite excited, but you really have to rethink how you engage with people and how you,
It helps, actually, if you have a more blended approach. So I was lucky. I run once a year, and which actually has been my major laboratory. I started, it must be the longest running course by one professor at our school. What I sometimes call this my CEO recycling program. I take 21 executives, very senior, and I have this fantasy. Of course, it's a fantasy. We all like to do something for the world. Those people are maybe responsible for 100,000 people. If I make them a little bit more humane, maybe it has a trickle effect to the rest of the organization. But change is very hard. But it's a modular program. This program started in, so it's kind of funny, it started in January, and I had the largest number of women ever. It's very hard to get women at the senior level. I really make an enormous effort when you compare it with our normal advanced management program. And I mean, I got this year 45% women, which is the largest number I ever had. The first module was fantastic, and I said to myself, this cannot last. Some defenses have to come, resistances are going to come to the second module. Something's going to go wrong. So maybe somebody becomes psychotic, who knows? No, I got a pandemic. That was the last thing I saw. So now I'm trying to keep the program alive, but it's very difficult because they come from 16 countries. And many of the countries are not on the list. So I don't see them coming for a while until you have an antidote. So it is it's a problem. I think when you have degree programs, people are more, it's easier. But not when you have those, you know, as you know, executive programs, it's difficult.
I think it's one thing a lot of people don't know about you. They know your books and they know your writings, but they don't know of your brilliance in the classroom and working with leaders directly. Can you say something about your approach when you're working directly with people?
I guess I learned teaching. I used to teach the core course at Harvard, at McGill, and at INSEAD. And I seem to have been a very good teacher because I always got a teaching award. So, but it's I don't know. I mean, I must admit, people sometimes ask me about, and that makes it so difficult doing things virtually. I guess it's like the director of an orchestra. I'm very intuitive, and to get people's attention. And you have a few, if you have a large class of MBA students, you have a few tricks about how to keep their attention. One thing, very simple one, is, you know their name and know their background. It's as simple as that. But some of it, and then you can really try to orchestrate. Now with CEOs, it's CEO types, it's different. And again, it is the question of when I have written, I mean, I'm a product of the Harvard Business School, so I used to use a lot of case studies. I've written probably more than 100 case studies myself. But in the class now, I use the life case study. And of course, what this CEO seminar does is it really taught me how to do group coaching. I mean, I think our school is probably the largest business school in the world doing, everybody gets coaching now. And in particular, are good in group coaching. And I'm not saying that face-to-face, you know, one-to-one coaching is not, one-to-one coach is not useful, but I always say more bang for the buck. And what always really irritates me is that when I talk to senior executives, they spend millions of dollars on IT systems, but their top management team is not aligned. And that costs much more money. And I try to tell them that. And actually, I've now reached a stage when I can tell them to buzz off when they want to. But basically, when I look at my own work and what my own agenda is, and I already mentioned part of the agenda in the first place, it has to do with self-awareness. And, you know, in the famous statement above the Temple of Apollo, know thyself, is still very valid, one of the most difficult things in the world. And most people are strangers to themselves. The second one is what always surprises me, that executives don't get the best out of their people. And actually, they don't know their people. And after the first module, they suddenly realize that they really, apart from some pleasantries, they really have no idea what they're all about. And so they start to have some more meaningful conversations with their people. The third thing, of course, has to do with, and I've written too much probably on narcissism, that many senior executives have a tendency to also follow Greek myth, hubris, to self-destruct.
Yes.
And how to prevent that. And of course, and I mentioned it earlier, top executive team, in my experience, are often an unnatural act. And they very often not aligned because there are too many other games, and you know about that, games being played. And so how to really align those? That is, I think, a very, and I always say, give me a somewhat neurotic executive team, and I can make something out of it in a few days. Of course, I always, before I do that, I do interview everybody very carefully, because I have seen certain situations where it's too crazy. And I mean, you can do certain, for example, I've written a few books on family business where you can really can see some intense craziness, which is extremely deeply rooted. It's more than just in a public company. You also have, of course, but in a family company, there's so many deep. it's always the same thing. It's the succession soap operas and sibling rivalry. That's what it's always about. And how to solve that. And I think there, somewhat often, what I used to call the clinical approach, which is probably a euphemism for the psychodynamic systemic approach, you really have better chance to make sense of what's called irrational behavior, which has, of course, a rationale.
Yeah, I mean, that's what struck me when I got into leadership work was there is so much in the management text around rational behavior. It's like we knew what to do rationally, but it clearly didn't answer the problem. And we had to start working with irrational. That's what got me into the psychoanalytic field and doing the work.
Now, basically, when I think about my history of my work, when I was studying at Harvard Business School, it was all about structure and strategy. And also when it came to INSEAD, I also felt that the left side of the people's brains was overdeveloped. And I felt it was my task to try to put it more in equilibrium and bring the human being back into the organization. So that has been really my agenda at INSEAD. And that's the reason I said I'm very pleased that now everybody gets some coaching. It's kind of funny. I think on 50 years ago, must be something like that or more than that, I studied my first university was the University of Amsterdam. And I usually don't volunteer to give lectures because I get too many requests. But I decided, I'm curious how the place is. So I wrote an email to the Rector Magnificus. That's the president, in Holland, called the Rector Magnificus. And said, hi there, I'm a graduate of your university and I would like to. I got an email back immediately. Said, hi there, I was your student. I guess I'm getting absent-minded. I remember their first names, but the last names I usually forget. I was your student. And part of that, she said, the dean of your faculty is also your student. So that was actually easy. And I gave a lecture and I was thinking, when I look at my cohort at the time, what had happened to them? Many of them became alcoholics. It was actually, maybe nowadays it's more drug, other kinds of drugs, but there's alcohol. And it was actually, in a way, as a student, people drank a lot. It was supposed to be. So alcoholics, they had bad marriages. I mean, look at their lives, and many of them are dead. I mean, prematurely dead. And I thought to myself, if I would have had something like Psychology 101, at the time I was a young student, and all my colleagues and my cohorts had the same, maybe that would have made a difference. I was actually telling that in my lecture. I was saying something like that. Because when you look at our MBA students, and I used to teach, I don't teach them anymore, I now teach gray-haired and balding gentlemen and gray-haired ladies, but not completely, I get some younger ones. But, what are the major decisions the younger students, the MBAs, who are on average 27, 28, I think, 28, have to make? It's finding a partner. And we don't do very well there. No. 50% failure rate or something like that. Depending on the culture. In Russia, it's a little bit higher, at least the students I get. And defining the job that fits you. Mm-hmm. Also, they don't do too well. So if they have a better sense of themselves, yeah, that would be a real enormous advantage. So at least now they get a little bit of coaching, not enough probably, because it's not mass production, as you know. That's one of the problems. It's easier to teach a big MBA class or whatever in the auditorium.
Yeah. Have you found over your period of training leaders that there's been a change towards a more humanistic, socially aware leadership? Has that opened up a bit, do you think, or is that a myth?
No, I mean, one thing when I look, I studied in the late 60s. I mean, actually, I went to Harvard at the late 60s. And at the time when I studied organizational behavior, nobody talked about emotional intelligence or culture. And that has changed. First, you had this seminal book, The Art of Japanese Management, which was also a model was in that. I don't know if you read the notebook now, it was a bestseller at the time.
Yeah.
It was a modeling of the 7S system of McKinsey. And then later on, of course, the Goleman came out taking the work of some people at Yale of emotional intelligence. And so now it is acceptable. You can talk about it. And I think many executives realize that talent and culture management is what's all about. If you want the difference between a good company and a great company. Also, I mean, I, I wrote some depressing books, and I recently wrote another depressing book. I used to be the depressant of organizations, by the way. All my work was fairly negative, you know, neurotic organization, struggling with the demon, organization on the couch. I mean, all these kind of things. So I would depress people. Then at one point in time, the dean asked me to become the head of our leadership center. So I had to get, I mean, we have pretty good people who come to our school. So I had to make good people even better. So I had to switch focus. But I mean, the big thing, of course, has to do with meaning. And when you look at meaning, and what I try to do, and that's the reason my CEO seminar has become my laboratory, because coming back to case studies, I've written, as I said, many case studies, but case studies, they have to be signed off by the person who is in the case. Right. So you do self-censorship, and you have a tendency to write hagiographies, because I've seen it so many times. So with the life case study, when you have people 4 weeks, you know, you cannot talk about the weather for 4 weeks. I mean, there are better things to do. You have to really start to talk about real meaningful things. And so I think when you talk about meaning, which they look for, one I think has to do with, and I always like the work of Irving Yalom, has to do with things like belonging. And of course, and this famous Harvard study, the longitudinal study, I think is a very good indication of the important need of, and of course, with the pandemic, the need for belonging has been really stifled in people being locked up. So belonging is essential. So having good relationship with family and friends. The other thing has to do with purpose, you know, that which is future oriented. It's different from meaning, the way I look at it. It's future oriented. Yeah. Then we talk about things like also choice. You know, I mentioned earlier already that we have to make choices in life. Did we pick the right partner? Did we pick the right job? Is this the right decision? So, of course, when you are at a poverty level, the choices might be more limited. You just want to have food for the next day. But many of the people, ideals, maybe have too much choice. And are they making the right choices? So, again, do you have some control over the choices? Then the thing has to do with, what are you really good at? You know, I mean, I think about my grandchildren. And, you know, what is their gift? What gives them a sense of flow? What is their competence? And how do you find your gift? I mean, you have people like Mozart, who found it very young and maybe influenced by Pa. I guess he had much of a choice. He was really a very musical family. But very often, how to figure out what really... I think about my friend who sent me every day a message from his Salmon River in the Gaspésie. Of course, I think he would love to be a professional salmon fisherman, probably the way it's going. But, and then you have, and I'm coming back to your question, I'm not forgotten, it has to do with a sense of transcendence. You know, people, I would say people work for money. You need to have some money, otherwise you go bankrupt. But they die for a cause. So to do something more. And the sad thing is that we always have to fight the greed factor. It's always there. And this is famous, the study about the tragedy of the commons. I know if you know that, what this, the tragedy of the commons. That, I mean, you are, I can give you an example. I have a friend not too far from here where I live, and this is house which is as fantastic houses. I mean, must be in a, you know, it's incredible.
Yeah.
However, there is one catch. The road is private. And they can't get their act together to repair that road. So to get to the house, you need better four-wheel drive. It's ridiculous. You have these spectacular houses. And, I mean, that's the trade of the common. I mean, there's one fish left in the lake. You're going to catch the last fish before the other people get it. And the greed factor, which I get quite excited about when you look at salaries of executives. I mean, the CEOs, it's perverse. I've really written about it. 300 times the average salary. What about all the other people? Mm-hmm. They don't do anything. Yeah. They are sitting on their hands. It's perverse.
It really is. Manfred, have you ever been involved in political leadership? I know you do. You write a lot about organizations. Do you get asked to coach or work with any political leaders, or do you steer very clear of it?
I used to actually teach at a program. It was it was run by the government office in the UK. And that was actually a nice program, because what they tried to do is to mix the public and the private sector to create some mutual understanding. So the senior executives of the public sector and of the private sector were mixed. I liked that program, and it's the problem is our school is, to be very frank, although we have now a center for government and social sustainability, but our prices are very high. You know, we talk about, and so we don't get. I get some of them, but not many. So it's not a logic. I don't get many political. I get some of them. I've gotten some, but not enough.
It's mainly the corporate sector, the business sector, which you've
been working also. I don't get enough entrepreneurs. I would like to have more entrepreneurs, because I think that's where really the action is very often. So those are, although we do produce, our school produces, I think, the largest number of entrepreneurs of any business school. We do produce lots of entrepreneurs, but the public sector, it's really, it has been a complaint. We got an enormous grant recently, so maybe that will help a little bit, that we can subsidize, give more scholarships, things like that. I would love to give scholarships, by the way, in my program, but executive education is a moneymaker. It's making it to subsidize the doctoral students, scholarships for the MBAs. That's the purpose. So,
And what ambitions do you have in your work with organizations and leadership? What would you like to see the next? I loved your recent ebook on COVID time and the pandemic and your thinking. And you said in that there's an opportunity, really. You can see that the kind of something is there's a possibility there now. What would you see could step into that space?
You are, Simon, you are a prophet of hope. You know, one hand, as a psychoanalyst, I mean, I'm also, my other hat is I'm a psychoanalyst. Although I'm not a real, even though I'm a member of the establishment, I do anything that works. So I'm terrible as a psychoanalyst. So, I mean, that's the reason I sometimes get tired of looking at the correspondence of ISPSO, where they go into intellectual masturbation, I must say, making things. I mean, very pragmatic person. I mean, I learned one important rule for my two analysts I had. Speak the language of your patients.
Sure.
And speak the language of your client. You know, don't start to confuse them with psychobabble and other gobbledygook. That's, my aim is, as I said earlier, is what can we do to create a better world? Because I wrote about what I call the six horsemen of the apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first one, of course, is our planet. Already 62, you had the Silent Spring. It was already a warning about that we are poisoning the planet. It was Rachel, I think. Then a few years later, I looked at the movie. You might have seen it. You're old enough. Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. You might have seen it. It was a funny movie by Kubrick, but not funny. A semi-tragic comedy about the nuclear cloud was always there. It's still there. So the second one. Then you have the things like income inequality. And this Piketty has really pointed it out. I mean, it has become worse and worse, and it's an invitation. I'm not surprised what's happening in the States. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a fire ready to go off. The way also the health system and the whole thing, it was predictable. So you have that. You have the quality of leadership, which, I mean, with the, you know, if Trump, I mean, I one of my last books, half of it is about Trump. I mean, I don't have to talk about narcissism anymore. Just show a video of this man. I mean, it is beyond the malignant narcissist. And he is, if he would be the head of a banana republic, fine. But he, yeah. I mean, people, he is the most powerful person in the world. And it's a terrible role model for anybody. Yeah. And of course, many people have been imitating him. I wrote a very satirical article the last days about precedents for life. Mm-hmm. But my wife was concerned that people would take me serious, you know. But I was more in the modest proposal, more in the Jonathan Swift kind of outrage. I was trying to be outrageous about all the advantages of a precedent for life. Not to me, you know, it's only misery. And of course, the last one is the pandemic. And now you can say this is the largest social experiment the world ever had. One third of the population has been locked up. Mm-hmm. Now, how people deal with it? I was lucky. And of course, given the nature of my work, I almost oriented to some reflectivity. I mean, that's part of my, I pay attention to my dreams and things like that. And lots of people contact me to talk about issues. And I was also very pleased to hear that some of my students, actually one of the chapters in that little book I wrote was because of a well-known executive who wrote me an email and said, thanks for the seminar. It was, I mean, the highest compliment I felt. And because of the seminar, he's actually quite an, he's not a very courageous person. He said, I had the courage to do something against the other members of the board. I said, we're not going to fire anybody. We're going to give our creditors a longer line of credit. And I'm collecting a lot. I take a complete salary cut and also top management team. And I'm going to, I collected so much money for it that PPE is not available. And he said it was an incredible positive influence on the corporate culture. He said this is, even though it will cost him some money in the short run, but in the long run, and that's the reason, by the way, this is kind of funny. I mean, as my psychoanalyst had a free associate, but I always was very cynical about family businesses.
Yeah.
But I am not so much anymore, because at least they look at the longer term, most of them, as opposed to the other ones who are haunted by quarterly results. And, you know, you get this hire and fire mentality, and also the greed mentality becomes more. And when you know as a CEO, you're only a few years there, let's get the maximum out of the company. Don't invest in R&D. Don't invest in training and development. Just get your buy. If you have some money, buy back shares so the stock price goes up. I mean, it's an opportunity. But there's a philosopher in France who was asked how the world looked like after the pandemic, and he said, he's a real cheerleader, the same, only worse.
Yeah.
I hope not. That's not my hope. I hope that when an antidote is found, that and I think also the younger generations are much more conscious about the environment than I think my generation has been in the past, and many of the, but still, don't underestimate the greed factor. And of course, you can say we are in developed, quote unquote, developed countries, but other countries are in a different stage. And they say, you know, we basically want to take care of our basic needs, and we're going to build more coal plants and whatever, and keep them polluting.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've noticed in my work, I wrote about eco-leadership and the environment in 2005, and it's very marginal. And now the big companies are saying we need to really think about this and how it works. Now, but at the same time, there's a shadow side. It's like that they want it, but they can have they still want to.
I think about Unilever. You had Polman, who made all this. Polman, who was trying to be visionary of Unilever, but he's no longer there. Huh?
Yeah, that's right.
So I don't know what happened in the boardroom, but you know, of course, you get some nice statements that you know you, because of personal reasons or whatever, you might be some other things going on. So there is this shareholder value concept, which was Michael Jensen at the time, who basically stopped talking about it. I think was a disastrous comment. Shareholder value, it's stakeholder value. There are so many constituencies. I remember once when I came back from America, I used lots of Harvard Business School cases, and my students started to complain. Said, "What about Europe?" So I asked, "So who are the heroes and leaders in Europe?" So there were at the time you had someone of Olivetti, Carlo Benedetti. You had also the head of Volvo, Per Jullenhammer, who was actually known for some innovative work experiments, and then you had Richard Branson. I had never heard of Richard Branson. So I wrote them all a letter, you know, a long letter, and said and pleaded for maybe get access to them, write a case study about them. And I remember Richard Branson sent me a telex, actually the same week, and said, "Hi, Manfred, please come." And so I went to his head office, which was a houseboat.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a very good symbol, because how many people can you have at head office? The houseboat sinks. The houseboat. And I asked him the usual questions. I remember one question from an actually funny from a clinical point of view. And I said, "You have such a crazy portfolio," I said to him. And said, "What about the airline? How do you get to the airline?" So he walked in the houseboat, went to another room in the houseboat, and he gave me a picture. And the picture was this woman, was a woman in an old-fashioned British Airways uniform. And I turned the picture around and said, "From an old virgin to a new virgin, love your mother." And his mother, talk about over-determination, used to be a stewardess. at BA, the first one who flew over the Andes. So I mean, there was lots of. But anyhow, what I am making a long story. What I always felt was interesting to him. He said, you know, the most important thing to me is that I have happy people. If people are happy in the company, they will smile at the customer.
Yeah.
And then you go to the shareholder value and the greed factor. And when you think about the Gallup poll that 85% of people worldwide don't feel engaged, I mean, you think what a waste. I mean, 50% likes their job, really. Yeah. So, I mean, there's so much work to be done, to be very frank, for people in the coaching and whatever. And even companies like McKinsey, I mean, I worked for a long time for their director program. They wanted to become more sensitive to understand what the clients are not saying, maybe. You know, that's very important, what's not being said.
What's not being said is vitally important, as we both know. You do a lot of work in Europe. You're based in France, and you've worked in the States a lot, and you're from Canada. And what about you know Russia well, you know Africa well, Asia. What's going on in those parts of the world, do you think, at the moment? Which
coming back to Pushkin. I like to read Russian literature when I was a student, so mm-hmm. I read the classics. Gogol, Pushkin, Chekhov, etc. And so, but I was intrigued by this crazy country which has produced such great literature and also beautiful music, and then being completely locked up. So I was so happy when Glasnost came, the country, you know, opened. And I was very early there. Yeah. Which is actually quite arrogant. Since I came, I have been there many, many times. I wrote an article at the time called The Anarchist Within. Mm-hmm. And it was about Russian character. And I personally believe, I speak 4.5 languages, that you only understand the culture when you speak the language.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I wrote an article about Russian character, which hit. And I got quite some reaction to it. I also got a Russian doctoral student who became a professor in Berlin afterwards. And so we decided to write a book about the new Russian business leaders. And there were actually quite some famous ones. One was, of course, the person called Khodorkovsky, who got 12 years locked up by Putin. And so I interviewed those people. And that really got my interest. So somehow, and then having supervision with my old analyst, my first analyst in Paris, Joyce McDougall, she's dead now. She was quite well known. She's a Kiwi, actually. I guess she had become quite French. She said that she had another supervisee who was Russian, and maybe since I was interested in Russia, maybe we should meet. So I had dinner with this gentleman, and he turned out to be a professor in psychology who was becoming a psychoanalyst. And you have met him, Andrei Rozovsky. You know, I was talking to him and said, listen, I mean, I'm such a bad analyst. I said, listen, you can have a few patients in your whole life, or you can have a much more greater impact because the country is changing. Yeah. So do something like I've been doing. I started this program at INSEAD with Roger and Eric on it's called CCC, Original Consulting and Coaching for Chess Master Program. And many of the graduates of the program actually became also members of ISPSO. I forgot to say, by the way, at the meeting there that a very good way of getting more members, because the membership has really increased, is giving a free membership to all the graduates for 1 year. That's the way to suck them in, I think, from a marketing point of view. I think it's a very smart way of doing it. Yeah. But anyhow, that's a sideshow. So he started a program there, which is quite ambitious. I talked to him a few days ago. Psychoanalytic psychology and I think management consulting at the High School of Economics, you know, the best school in Russia. It has extremely popular. I mean, after communism, I think they're looking for a new ideology. I hope it's not psychoanalysis, but it's better than communism. So he has been actually over successful, and he calls me the patriarch of the program. That's where I'm introduced.
He does. I was there teaching on it, and you're very well thought of there. And he was talking about you, and like you say, it's very successful. It's really quite dynamic, and it's exciting to teach there. wonderful students and very vibrant.
They're wonderful students. I think so too. That's I always enjoy teaching there. I go there. I did a virtual session, three hours.
Yeah, it's not the same.
No.
Fred, we're coming to an end. I like to ask my guests a final question. This podcast is about what it takes to live a good life and to create the good society. Have you any thoughts for our listeners on what it might take to live a good life and to create a good society?
I think you have to start with yourself, Simon. And a good life is to have good relationships with your family and friends. If you don't have that, it can be very abstract. I always think about Joan Baez, the singer, who said, I have a very good relationship with my audience, thousands of people, but my family, that's the problem. So, I mean, it's important to be, quote-unquote, this overused word, authentic, that you have. And I think in that respect, if you are this kind of sense of, if you have those good relationships, I hope you can expand it to a larger audience. I mean, we are very lucky, I always say, in the education business. When you talk about meaning, I mean, that's, think about just selling, so as Stephen Jobs used to say, sugared water. This is Coca-Cola, so cola. This is very different than what we do. We are in the meaning business and helping people to discover themselves, creating tipping points in their life. And now it's sometimes bricolage, but you don't know the after effects, like this gentleman who wrote me an email. I mean, thousands of people work for him. So that seminar, whatever, has influenced him to think about things differently and has benefited thousands of people.
That's right. Well, that's lovely. Thank you very much for sharing your wisdom, Manfred. It's been fantastic talking to you. I hope you enjoyed it.
The same. And good luck.
We'll talk again.
Bye.
Bye now. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact Simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.